Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Throughout its history, the White House has undergone many changes. They include the building of an East Wing and an Oval Office, and a major overhaul of the interior. However, the latest change involving the destruction of the East Wing to be replaced by a grand ballroom could be its most controversial renovation based on the media coverage it's been receiving. We're talking about the history of the White House and concerns raised by the latest change to what has been referred to as the People's House. We're going to begin the hour with a look at the history of White House renovations with Chad Hankinson, an Americanist and political science lecturer at Virginia Tech. Welcome to All Sides, Chad.
Thank you very much for having me, Amy.
So from a swimming pool to a bowling alley, the White House has undergone changes over the years. In your opinion, what is the most significant renovation to the complex throughout history? We'll leave the current one aside, but, you know, in history.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to say what is the most significant, right? That what we've seen happen to the White House over time is that presidents certainly try to put their mark on the House. Some of that is just interior changes to decorations, some of those more minor remodels. But like with the ballroom, we're talking about, you know, a really major construction project here that changes the entire aesthetic of the exterior of the White House. And so, you know, we see, some of these kind of additions to the White House, the addition of a third floor, the first small addition of what was the East Wing, which was essentially just a very small addition to accommodate formal guests, so a guest entrance. And then the expansion of the East Wing under FDR, that ostensibly was done in order to obscure the presidential bunker. And then from 48 to 52, there was a complete gut remodel to, you know, reassure the structural soundness of the White House. So it's gone through some, you know, some big changes. And yes, the Trump ballroom is arguably one of the biggest changes that could really alter the aesthetic of the White House.
Yeah, it was Calvin Coolidge a long time ago who added the third floor. I would have to think adding an entire floor, I mean, that's a huge deal to a house.
Yeah, absolutely. A major undertaking. But, you know, something that was done because, as we saw, just the job of the president, right, the role of the presidency evolving and changing, and presidents doing more, taking on more staff, having more people work in the White House, and presidents spending more time in the White House. These kinds of changes over time were typically done to accommodate those larger staff so that there was more working space, or to just create a more comfortable living space for the president and their family.
Ohio native William Howard Taft added the Oval Office in 1909. Do you know, was there any controversy or with adding that or making it an oval?
I'm not aware of any real controversy for that, right? The West Wing was first built, I think, in 1904 under Roosevelt. But yes, it was the addition of the Oval Office to give the president that office space that we have come to, you know, really associate with the presidency. But I'm not aware of any major controversy that really existed at that time. Mm.
And Harry Truman commissioned a complete gut and remodel and added the Truman balcony. Was there any Truman controversy with the White House?
Not really so much, because that was about structural soundness. Mm. That engineers, they inspected the White House and said if there wasn't this major remodel, that the building would likely collapse. So, this was just a necessary thing to keep the White House as we know it fully intact.
So in an article, you were quoted as saying it's not unusual for a president to renovate or redecorate the White House. I mean, do most presidents make at least some changes, or overall, do most presidents leave it alone?
No, pretty much every president is going to make changes, whether or not we're talking about Richard Nixon adding the bowling alley or FDR, the swimming pool, Barack Obama converting the tennis courts to basketball courts. Bill Clinton did things to make the White House more friendly for the internet. You know, you see presidents do things just to interior decorating. So just changes from the Biden administration to the, you know, to the Trump administration. Trump, when he first took office in 2016, completely redecorated the Oval Office and put in artwork that was more consistent to kind of maybe of his view of like Americana, also, you know, paying homage to conservative figures. When Biden took the White House in 2020, he changed all of that artwork, you know, paying homage to civil rights icons. So a lot of times they'll make these kinds of interior changes to reflect personal style, political views, or just maybe the changing nature of, you know, our preferences for design and decoration.
Yeah, I saw an image of Bill Clinton's movie theater, and it definitely looked like it was made in 1994. So, I'm sure the movie theater has been renovated since then.
That I'm not sure of, if there has been a major renovation to the theater.
Yeah, well, I can't imagine that they kept those curtains there. But anyway, you know, that's a 90s joke. So have you actually toured the White House?
I have. It's been a long time. I toured the White House actually when I worked on Capitol Hill back in the mid-90s.
Mid-90s. Okay. So, yeah. I don't know. Bill Clinton time-ish?
Clinton time, yes.
Okay. Did you have a favorite part?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's been so long. It's hard for me to remember if I had a favorite part. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just kind of felt, you know, pretty in awe and inspired to be there, you know, when you think about the White House. You know, I'm able to go back to D.C. quite often, and was just there a few months ago and walked past the White House again. Didn't go in, but just walked past it. And, you know, it's an important symbol, I think, of, you know, American democracy, right, of the presidency of the United States. And so, you know, just to be in the White House was a pretty special moment for me.
Yeah, I got to tour the White House, too. I toured it in 2018. And my favorite part was the seeing the White House press room, because I was able to sit in the NPR seat like a true public radio nerd. So that's pretty on the nose for me, though. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about the history of White House renovations with Chad Hankinson, an Americanist and political science lecturer at Virginia Tech. So when you think of how homes have changed, you know, from the days of gas lamps to electricity, and now we need internet connections, updating even something as historic as the White House, aren't they necessary to keep pace with the times?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think why it's not been that controversial when we have these kinds of things happen, right? Nobody made any kind of waves about, you know, Clinton doing the kind of work in the White House that was required to accommodate, you know, our modern communication, use of the internet, that over time the White House has had to have changes to its heating systems, its electrical systems, just to keep up with the times. And so that's going to have to be something that continues to happen into the future. And, you know, I don't think it's the kind of stuff that's really going to get people like upset, or, you know, it's not going to be very controversial whatsoever.
You mentioned earlier a bunker. Tell me about the added security of having a bunker in the White House. What was that?
Well, so that's, you know, the place where, you know, especially in more modern times, if there was some threat, imminent threat of nuclear war or an assault on the White House, that the president can go and be in this secure underground bunker. You know, perhaps you remember the story. I mean, here we just have, you know, Dick Cheney passing away here, you know, yesterday. And, you know, so obviously he's been in the news again. But, you know, the stories of him being swept up by the Secret Service on September 11th, when he was in the White House and made, you know, to go to this secure location to make sure that he would be safe. So this is where the president, vice president, family, major staffers will go if there's some kind of threat to the White House.
And did you say that they built some, like, was it the East Wing or the West Wing? Something, the East Wing, I guess, was built to obscure the bunker?
Yes. The East Wing, as we knew it until a few days ago, was built over the bunker. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So is the bunker still there, even though the East Wing now is gone?
I guess it still has to be there.
Right? It's underground? I don't know.
It's underground. So, okay. It's just going to be exposed, I guess, for a little while until we have this latest project completed.
Okay. Hopefully it still works. But then also, like, President Obama is known for adding, well, you mentioned the basketball court, but like on a more serious note, he added more security too to the White House. Didn't he add, a lot more of security features?
Yes, we saw more security added during the Obama administration. There was also added security during the Bush administration. So these kinds of security updates are things that that will change, obviously, as like kind of the threats that exist, kind of evolve and change with technology.
Let's talk about the destruction of the East Wing. So, and why I get and why it's been so controversial. So we just listed off a whole bunch of renovations that have happened to the White House. Were they all explained in a more public manner? Did they not all not happen so suddenly? Why do you think there has been so much news and media coverage of what the East Wing looks like now?
Yeah, I think that this really spans some different explanations here. I think for one, when you look at all of the other major exterior work that's been done, that this was done really before we had kind of our modern means of media. And the presidency itself wasn't nearly as a central focus of the news media. So even when you think about the major remodel in like 48 to 52, presidents could kind of be out of the spotlight a bit. So I think this is a little bit of a an artifact of our 24-hour news cycle, the fact that we're covering news really so in depth, and that we just have different means of communicating the news now. So we focus on these things. I think when you also look at it in that context, I mentioned earlier the White House being an important symbol of American democracy, that most of us don't get to go to the White House like you and I and take a tour, right? Many Americans are maybe able to go to DC and see the outside of the White House. But for millions of Americans, they're never going to go to DC and see the White House in person, but they're going to see it on TV. They're going to see that visual imagery of it. And so we've grown kind of accustomed, right, to what the White House looks like. And again, it acts as this important symbol for us. And so I think for some people, it's kind of about destroying or at least, tampering that symbol in a substantial way, right? So it kind of, taps into our feelings of maybe like nostalgia or how things should be. I certainly think that other issues here, though, with the controversy surrounding this is the size and how it could potentially alter, what we see as the White House. I mean, the White House itself is 55,000 square feet. This ballroom is going to be about 90,000 square feet. So almost twice the size of the White House itself, right? And so that's, I think, a big concern for some people, that it just may overshadow, right, the White House, this large ballroom. I think other things, right, surrounding the controversy are just the timing of this, right? That we have the government shutdown going on, that we have tens of thousands of federal government workers who are furloughed from work and not earning a paycheck right now. We still have relatively high unemployment. I think our last numbers on unemployment were 4.3%. We've started to see inflation tick back up again. And the results of elections yesterday around the country demonstrate that American voters are concerned about the economy. The reason why they went out and voted for the candidates they voted for is because they have these broader economic concerns. And so when you take on such a lavish project, even though this is going to be privately funded, I think it really sends a bad message to the American people when they're really concerned about like these kind of kitchen table issues and how their pocketbooks are being affected by things that are going on in the larger economy.
I wanted to ask you about the private funding. All those other renovations that we mentioned, from Calvin Coolidge's third floor to Harry Truman's big gut job and remodel, were they publicly funded or do you privately funded?
These are publicly funded. Mm-hmm. The Congress would appropriate the funds for these projects, right? This is the normal, course of procedure. And obviously, this is another one of the concerns that people have, that is this going to cause some kind of maybe ethical concerns here? So if you look at the list of companies that, and I think it's 37 companies, 37 different donors that have given money to this project that, right now is estimated at, $300, what are we looking at, $300 million, that the companies in total receive about $279 billion in government contracts. I mean, does this really create a conflict of interest? And will these donors expect something in return, if nothing else, that means an audience with the president to hear their concerns? Will they expect things even worse? We're applying for government contracts. We gave you money here for your passion project. We want to get something in return. So I think a lot of people are concerned about those ethical issues here with that private financing.
We've been speaking with Chad Hankinson, an Americanist and political science lecturer at Virginia Tech. Thank you for joining us today, Chad.
Thank you very much for having me, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to have an architect weigh in on White House renovations. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. Is there something you've always wondered about Columbus? Submit a question at WOSU.org/curious.
The Trump administration is firing scores of immigration judges, and an NPR investigation shows there may be some common threads.
Anyone who ever represented a non-citizen at any point in their lives, whether they also worked for DHS, whether they worked for ICE, that seems to be the indelible stain that got them fired.
I'm Juana Summers. Hear it from the judges themselves on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Ohio is home to a remarkable archaeological wonder constructed by indigenous ancestors thousands of years ago. The Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, is recognized worldwide as a marvel of human ingenuity on par with the pyramids. We'll learn more about the stories written on this land. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jurevich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Despite promising not to touch the building, President Trump moved forward with his plans to demolish the east wing of the White House.
The new ballroom will be lavish and dwarf the current east wing. President Trump previously promised the new addition would leave the White House intact.
Won't interfere with the current building. It won't be. It'll be near it, but not touching it. And pays total respect to the existing building, which I'm the biggest fan of. It's my favorite.
The latest renovations to the White House has angered many because of its scale and the speed at which the changes are happening. Joining us now is Priya Jain, an associate professor of architecture at Texas A&M University. Professor Jain is an historic preservation architect, educator, and chair of the Society of Architectural Historians Heritage Conservation Committee. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Jain.
Thank you for having me.
What was your initial reaction when you heard about the plans to build a grand ballroom on the White House grounds?
Sure. So there was an immediate concern, and not just from, I think personally from my side, but largely from the architecture and preservation community. And, you know, as the chair of the Heritage Conservation Committee, we do this routinely, like we're on the lookout for projects that may be threatened by demolition or new additions, and we kind of advocate on their behalf. So clearly, you know, when the White House was in the news, it was on everybody's radar because it is probably the most important building in the US and an international symbol, right, of our government and democracy. So when the plans were announced, we heard from a lot of folks, architects, historians, what's going on? You know, this seems like a really big addition. Are you guys going to issue a statement? And we immediately kind of started looking at, you know, what was at play here and what types of rules and regulations and oversight such a project at the White House should be subject to.
Well, there's a lot of people who justify these latest changes, pointing out there's been a lot of renovations of the White House in the past. So why not build this ballroom?
Sure. And you know, that I mean, as somebody who has worked on historic buildings my entire career, that is true for every historic building that is in constant use, except for, you know, the few that are, let's say, house museums. But even then, you know, you have to incorporate life safety, technology, and so many other things. And with a building like the White House, a lot of documents actually for the White House call it a living museum. Mm-hmm. So recognizing that there is a lot of important history there, but also the fact that it has to be constantly used for very important functions. So we recognize that, and I have absolutely no problem with the fact that the White House has recognized this need for an extensive ballroom and their current buildings don't have the capacity for it. I think that's a legitimate need, a programmatic need. However, with most historic buildings, that need then gets worked on along with the other competing considerations like history, you know, impact to the historic building. So there was an opportunity here to do that and to right size the building, to think of options that would have mitigated the impact to the historic fabric and minimized that impact. And that opportunity, and honestly imperative, I think that the administration had, was lost here.
As a historic preservation architect, what are the protocols the administration should have followed to make changes to the White House if it is a living museum? Did they need permits?
Yes. And so I mean, yes, there is. So, you know, there are very kind of well-established processes that are in place in the United States for buildings that are either federally owned or where federal monies are involved, for the government to kind of evaluate its impact to historic, cultural, and natural resources. As has been kind of pointed out in the news already, one of the main vehicles of doing this is something called a Section 106 review that is was enshrined under the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. It exempted three buildings from this review, which would have been extensive and all in the public domain. And these three buildings were the White House and its grounds, the Supreme Court building and its grounds, and the U.S. Capitol and its grounds. Mm-hmm. So because of that exemption, I think the White House kind of utilized that to forego the more involved Section 106 process. However, there are other considerations. There are protections against the National Environmental Policy Act that is sometimes combined with Section 106, but is also its own separate process. And because the White House is actually a national park that is managed by the National Park Service, it is imperative for them to kind of evaluate the impact of this project under NEPA. So when this project was announced, the White House said that they had worked with the National Park Service on some consultations. Unfortunately, those are not in the public domain. Now, the NEPA process would have required them to put this under public domain. So that is still something that we're looking for. It seems like that NEPA evaluation has to be submitted when this project goes up to the National Capital Planning Commission. So the National Capital Planning Commission is a regulatory body that has oversight over any federal projects that happen in DC, in Washington, DC. So that is because of the virtue of this project located where it is. So we're hoping that that documentation will be submitted and made public when this project goes up for review to the NCPC. It is unfortunate that this did not happen before demolition was undertaken. So that's unfortunate. But yes, there are multiple laws, regulations, and policies in place that have been followed on prior White House projects that it seems were not followed in this case.
Does the private funding of the Grand Ballroom allow for the administration to bypass some of these hurdles that you're talking about when making a renovation? They didn't need Congress to give them the money.
Sure. Now, if the money had been requested from Congress, absolutely. There would have been kind of broader discussions on kind of the need of this space, the amount of money that it would involve, because it would have to come from the public. So yes, absolutely. I think that did play a role in this. However, some of the things that I pointed out were just expansion of an exemption that was allowed to a wider set of policies that it is, to me, it is unclear how that was done, because those other reviews should have still happened, like the NEPA review, because they have happened on prior White House projects.
The Washington Post printed an opinion piece in defense of the Grand Ballroom, saying that the White House has long needed a bigger event space for state dinners and other events. So do you think this is a strong argument, saying the White House was in need of this Grand Ballroom?
Right. Like I said, I mean, I think that's a valid point. The White House needed a ballroom. However, I do take I do not agree with this categorization that it had to be either the tent or this ballroom. Mm-hmm. I think that negates the variety of design options that existed in between. For example, could the East Wing have been remodeled internally to accommodate this White House, which, again, we would should have had a conversation. Do we need a space for 650 people? Would a 500-person ballroom be sufficient? Now the ballroom is up to 1,000 people, right? So that conversation around whether how big the ballroom needed to be, could it have fit within the existing East Wing? Could perhaps demolishing one wall of the East Wing and expanding it out on one side would have sufficed? Could there be another location on the White House grounds? Could the White Ballroom have been partially underground or fully underground? These were all design options that are routinely evaluated on a historic building of this importance whenever a new addition is planned. So unfortunately, I don't agree with that argument that it had to be either the tents or this large ballroom.
Well, and I should note, I mentioned that this was a Washington Post opinion piece in defense of the Grand Ballroom, and Jeff Bezos is the owner of the Washington Post, and he's a major donor to the Grand Ballroom. So there's that. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the destruction of the East Wing of the White House and plans to replace it with a Grand Ballroom. With us, we have Priya Jain, Associate Professor of Architecture at Texas A&M University. What are the biggest challenges when you're renovating and remodeling historic buildings like the White House that are they're actively being used? They've been in service for a long time, but they need an update. Not even this example, but just in general. How hard is it to do a renovation of a historic building in Washington, D.C.?
Right. I mean, preservation is hard work. I won't deny that. But, you know, it is work that we as a nation, you know, invest our time and energy in. The U.S. has had a long history. I mean, we've kind of reached this point of wanting to care for our national heritage through successive losses, because we have lost buildings, lost national monuments, natural areas, because there was not adequate protection. And it is really not just about the bricks and the mortar. It is really about the history of the nation, about the people and the stories. And when you lose these buildings and these physical places and these tangible connections to the past, it becomes infinitely difficult to be able to tell those stories. So we have reached this point. I mean, the 1966 National Historic Preservation Act and these reviews that were put in place was because of large-scale destruction of historic sites and this recognition by Congress that unless we act, this destruction and demolition is going to continue. So I want to also emphasize that even though the White House has gone through successive changes, this is the first one that is kind of happening since the preservation field has evolved. We now know better how to take care of our historic buildings, and we do that on projects across the nation. We put in that time and effort. So it kind of behooves us as a country to, you know, give that same and the highest level of that care to our most important national buildings.
And I think what you're referring to is like the fields of architecture and historic preservation have advanced significantly, especially since World War II. So what have you realized since World War II that we weren't doing well before when it comes to historic preservation?
Right. So absolutely, this idea that evaluating the significance of the resource of the existing building. Now, in this case, I know the East Wing was kind of routinely dismissed as not amounting to much and that it was a building built, you know, after World War II. But that's pretty significant. That means that even if we think, I mean, I should push back that the East Colonnade, that was also a casualty in this recent demolition, was actually from 1902. So it was quite old. And the East Wing was existed in some shape and form since 1902 as well. It was expanded in 1942. So in this time period, right now, we've recognized that we need to evaluate the significance of that wing, which housed the offices of the First Lady. And that is like an expansion of women's role in politics, in the presidency. There was an opportunity to be able to tell those stories through the East Wing, and the demolition of it kind of doesn't allow you to do that anymore. So I should also point out that any building in the United States that is more than 50 years old, whether it's in your city, town, and if you know your local historic district commission is doing a survey, they actually look at it as a historic resource. So even if the East Wing was from 1942, it was way over 50 years old and should have had an evaluation of its own historical significance, separate from the central executive mansion.
Do you know where the First Lady's offices went? I didn't read any of that in my prep for the show.
Right. I don't know where they're right now,
but
from what I've read, it seems like the ballroom space will have a section for the First Lady's offices. So it'll still be there somewhere, but it's not clear from the plans because they haven't been released.
Well, what you were talking about any building over 50 years old being looked at, I mean, how do cities like Washington, D.C., Boston, Philadelphia, a large part of the city's identity is historic architecture. How do these cities modernize while still embracing the heritage? How do you balance that?
Absolutely. I mean, these projects are happening all over. The Department of Homeland Security in Washington, D.C. was a large project, a still ongoing project that adaptively reused a hospital, a very historic hospital from the 1850s. And that is a project that I worked on. And it went through the entire Section 106 process, which means that as architects and designers working on that project, we had to be very mindful of protecting the historic buildings, their integrity, of not designing additions that would overwhelm the building in shape and size. We were limited by, and rightfully so, right? Because we were trying to be respectful to the historic building in terms of our impact. So a lot of stakeholders were involved. That is the other thing I wanted to point out, that in these large federal projects, recognizing that, you know, it can't be just one person's design idea or a small group of people, that you really have to build a consensus. You have to build the various stakeholders that may have the potential to add value to your deliberations into the process. And most preservation projects rely on this consultation procedure, which is very important. And that allows you to come up with a design that is in many ways the optimal and best possible solution for the historic structure.
Well, the East Wing's gone, the Grand Ballroom's being built. So how do you think this latest renovation of the White House will influence future renovations? Is it going to make them easier or harder? Are people going to be like, no, you can't do anything now? Or is it just going to be that, you know, the next president and the president after that, everyone will change everything?
Right. And so, like I said, I mean, to me, this project is a break from a preservation practice, best practices, policies currently in the country. So I hope it, I mean, my fear is that, yes, it does send a signal across the nation about a weakening towards a weakening of preservation laws and ethics and standard of care. However, I do hope that it serves as a wake-up call. I wish that that doesn't happen, but it really serves as a wake-up call, recognizing that we actually need to work harder to make sure that, you know, we are much more mindful when designing additions to such significant buildings such as the White House. I should also point out that other buildings that are exempt from the Section 106 process, like the state, like the Supreme Court and the U.S. State Capitol that I mentioned earlier, they both have actually undergone big additions in the last 2 decades, 2008 and 2011. The State Capitol actually was in need of a large visitor center, and that was designed over this very long period of consultation, of reworking the design, and that addition is mostly underground. And it states explicitly that that was done to protect the historic significance of the building and to avoid any major visual impact. So there are ways, there are good ways to do this, and has been done on many federal projects across the nation.
Our guest has been Priya Jain, an associate professor of architecture at Texas A&M University. Thank you so much for your time today, Priya.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, an Ohio State architecture professor and former D.C. resident offers his perspective on the loss of two historic gardens as a part of the White House renovation as well. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. While the White House has experienced many renovations, the latest involving the destruction of the East Wing for a grand ballroom could be the most controversial. While the demolition of the East Wing has been front and center, two historic gardens have also been lost, as Rachel Maddow reported.
Before President Trump bulldozed a third of the White House last week, he had already paved over one of its most beautiful and iconic places. Destroying the White House Rose Garden, literally paving it, cost nearly $2 million. And then the excavator showed up. Last week, in tearing down the historic East Wing of the White House, Trump destroyed not just the East Wing, but also a second historic garden, the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden, which, despite the name, was not designed by Jackie Kennedy. The garden was named in Mrs. Kennedy's honor, but it was designed by her friend, the legendary gardener, Bunny Mellon.
So we're getting an architect's perspective on the latest White House renovations this hour, and joining us now is John Dean Davis, assistant professor at the Knowlton School of Architecture here at Ohio State, and he's also a former resident of Washington, D.C. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So leading up to the show, you said that you found the dramatic demolition photos of the East Wing to be fascinating. Why were they fascinating?
So everyone gets very excited about demolition. I remember being a small kid being really excited about seeing buildings get knocked down. I think what's interesting about it and the fact that people had such reactions to it was that probably most people didn't really think about the East Wing at all. Didn't even know much about its architecture, but it getting demolished and the pictures of it, you know, being all over the news stirred something in them that they realized that they actually cared about it, which to me is fascinating because it means that architecture isn't just a kind of background. It's not a, a screen set, but it has serious symbolic content and plays a role in people's lives that maybe they're not even aware of.
Mm. And in the introduction, we mentioned that there's been paving over of the Rose Garden. So some critics feel this is all called hospitality architecture. Can you tell me what is hospitality architecture?
So it's a specialty that architecture firms will kind of, get really good at. It encompasses the design of hotels, resorts, places that are temporary and where you know, you're supposed to attract guests who are going to spend money there, and they want to feel special and that it's a kind of release from their everyday lives. And I can see how, given the president's, you know, history of being involved with hotels and that's his kind of development specialty, that people would be uneasy with this kind of appearing at a government building all of a sudden.
What do you make of the... you know, not just the Rose Garden, but we also mentioned the Kennedy Garden being, you know, kind of like swept up in all of this. There's, yeah. You know, big changes, you know, because gardens are not necessarily architecture, but they're a part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I at OSU, I teach landscape history courses. Mm. So this is pertinent to me also. The gardens are interesting to me because they are, you know, artifacts of the 60s, of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And the White House grounds for a long time, I mean, not much attention had been paid to them. There are, you know, before the 1900 renovations, there were horse stables there. It was dusty, like it was a mud pit, basically. And that's a long-standing criticism of D.C. that foreign visitors had when they came in the 19th century, before the Macmillan Plan and the kind of modernization of the National Mall, where it was a mess. You would have these monuments spread out across, you know, huge dust bowls and a couple of scraggly houses. And so the gardens are important, but... they are recent additions to this kind of landscape. The mall had been a bunch of Victorian kind of gardens, these twisty, you know, small spaces. And those were all gone. And we have the National Mall now. And people think that has been there for forever, and it hasn't. Mm.
Our previous guest mentioned that the White House and its grounds are a national park. I don't even think I realized that. So it's like a national park that you can't go to without special permission, right?
Exactly. But you can go on the National Mall. And I mentioned that I lived in D.C. for 2 years and my daughters were born there. And the city has a special place in my heart. It's a really beautiful and green city. And part of it is because so much of it is maintained as green space by the federal government. Mm-hmm. So not only the mall, which anyone can go to and has, you know, big political significance, but Rock Creek Park is, you know, run by the National Park Service. And it's this amazing kind of oasis that runs through the city, and you can go jogging in there. And so the city is run through with all of these federal spaces that are beautifully maintained. And it's kind of great to, you know, ride your bike to the Library of Congress, like what I was doing when I was working on my dissertation, and ride past the White House and ride past all of these places on public bike paths. It's a special place in a way. I can see why people are really worked up about it.
Well, I mean, Washington, D.C. has many buildings that are symbols of our nation. The White House is one of them. But why did people have such a strong reaction? I mean, that city, you said, has been constantly changing for 200 years. I'm sure it used to look way different even 40 or 50 years ago. So why such a strong reaction to a third of the White House?
Well, I think there are two ways to answer that, for me at least. One is the architect and architectural historian in me, which knows that, you know, when James Hoban designed the original White House, he was basing it on this really well-established and very fine kind of precedent of architecture, Palladian architecture, which Thomas Jefferson used, and was really a foundational aesthetic that the founding fathers used when designing, you know, what is the symbolic content of this new republic. We're going to make references to the Roman Republic, and we're going to use Palladian architecture to do it. And so when I see plans for a really gigantic box kind of attached to the side of what is a fine example of Palladian architecture, the historian in me goes, that's that does not work at all, or it's not, you know, it's not in the spirit of what's going on here. More than, you know, it has columns or it has classical elements to it, it's more that the proportions are way off. I think that there's something about the, you know, we talked about, or the previous guest talked about the Section 106 process and all of that, is that there's an element of violence to just demoing a piece of a building, and then you create a kind of fait accompli where, oh, well, now we can do whatever we want to on it, that I think really shook people up. People are used to participating in these kinds of processes, and it is amazing that people believe that, you know, they have ownership over these buildings. And I think it's right for them to feel that way.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the renovation and reuse of historic buildings with John Dean Davis, assistant professor in the Knowlton School of Architecture here at Ohio State. Let's talk about the history of the city for a little bit. I read a piece in the Washington Post that said that it's difficult to renovate a home in historic neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. There's hoops to jump through, permits to get, checks and balances, all of that. So it seemed to one person who was quoted in this article that the White House didn't have to get any approvals, but they weren't allowed to just change a little thing on their house. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I mean, this is a familiar complaint. I think that, and also it speaks a lot about the president's kind of history of being a real estate developer too, is that you kind of get a peek into the construction industry where it's hard to preserve something that no longer exists. Mm-hmm. And there's all sorts of sleights of hand that happen in the construction industry where if you're faced with having to renovate a historic building, it's a lot more costly than knocking it down and building something brand new. Mm-hmm. And I know this because I own an 130-year-old house, and I feel like every single weekend I have to do something to it to keep it going. You have to be very careful. There's a lot of preparatory work that goes into preserving facades and preserving ancient masonry and rebuilding things that may have gotten damaged. So, yeah, if they could avoid it, people will just knock it down and build something new just from a purely cost standpoint. I think that the permitting process and maintaining these buildings is important because, as I said, I live in a 130-year-old house. That house is going to be there a long time after I'm long gone. That's different from a lot of the suburban houses that are built in this country. So I think there's a lot of value in the way that things were built in the 19th century and doing this kind of adaptive reuse. I think it really, from an energy standpoint, from a money standpoint, it is the way to go.
Talk to me about, from an architectural standpoint, the balance of the White House. I mean, obviously, it's not going to look balanced anymore once they add this ballroom on the east side. So then someone's going to say, well, we need a big room on the west side to make it balanced. Even if they add columns to the front of the ballroom on the east side, it's still, from certain angles, will probably stand out. I mean, what does that make you feel as an architect?
Yeah, if you were trying to keep with the spirit of what Hoban did and what Latrobe did in their kind of additions to it in the early 19th century when it was born or when it was first built, mm-hmm. There's an idea that the centerpiece of the building is the most prominent, mm-hmm. and it's important to emphasize that as the most prominent, and that the wings are going to be secondary in mm-hmm. a kind of hierarchy that you set up. That has been thrown out the window. I don't mm-hmm. necessarily think the best idea is to say, okay, I've made a huge mistake in the proportions on one side, therefore I have to correct it on the other side. But the West Wing also has a history of being known as a really cramped space, and they're jammed in there and it's tiny. I wouldn't be surprised if that argument gets made. I'll also say that the office space requirements has been a long-term point of contention in the Federal District. Going back to the Civil War, they were seizing buildings around the White House and converting them into army buildings in order to administer the war effort. Ulysses Grant commissioned the giant executive office building, which is right next to it. So it's in the background of all of these photos, mm-hmm. which is this huge granite Victorian heap. And people hated it when it was yeah. built. I mean, they just, and now it's just part of the background. And
you get used to it?
Yeah, you get used to it. It's like, oh, this has always been there.
So will people get used to President Trump's ballroom?
I imagine so. The other thing about the views of the White House, because the security cordon has been pushed so far out, mm-hmm. The views are obscured of the East and the West Wing by trees mm-hmm. and by bushes. So really, visually, you do concentrate on the center part of it. But there are limits to how much of a giant box you can cover up with trees.
You mentioned in preparing for the show, you said that most of what we consider permanent symbols of federal power were actually built very recently. So is that the example you were giving where you're talking about like the mall and the Washington Monument and stuff?
Yeah. So there's a when I was doing research for my book, I found a watercolor of the Washington Monument and it was halfway built and they ran out of money. And you can actually see it if you look at it. Today, you can see where the limestone changes because they paused the construction for a while. So it is this halfway built kind of thing with a crane sticking out of it. And there's marshland in the front because the east end of the mall basically ended in the Potomac River and it was all marshy and it would flood periodically. And that's the way the monument, Washington Monument, looked for a while until they had enough money to kind of do it. The reflecting pool, the Lincoln Memorial, all of that stuff was built in the early 20th century when there was a group of senators who decided that they were tired of everyone saying that Washington, D.C., the capital of this newly emergent world power, was a marshland and swamp, and it had a dirty canal running through the center of it. And they needed to build the monumental core. They needed to build the Federal Triangle. They needed to get rid of all the Victorian landscaping, regularize this, and turn it into a symbol of, you know, the power of the United States. And that's where, you know, all this engineering happened, where they turned the tidal basin with all it's surrounded by cherry blossoms or cherry trees now, but it's a working tidal gate that prevents that end of the mall from flooding. The Corps of Engineers has all of these flood protection things out there, so it's. There's been a concerted effort to transform this into an area that kind of meets the image that the people in charge of DC want to project. And I see this as kind of another example of that.
Well, we'll see what happens because, you know, it's going to be built at this point, right?
Apparently so.
Apparently so. Well, our guest has been John Dean Davis, assistant professor of the Knowlton School of Architecture at Ohio State. Thank you so much for joining us today on All Sides.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
And you're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.